Always present and yet invisible is the way that Paul Jennings could have been described. He was a slave who worked as a valet and body man for our fourth president, James Madison, at his Montpelier estate in Virginia. Despite being a slave, Jennings lived a remarkable life. He wrote the first White House memoir, helped save a national treasure during the War of 1812, was a sole observer of President Madison's death, and aided many slaves who sought freedom. Elizabeth Dowling Taylor spent years combing through historical records and Jennings' own writings, and the result is a book she's called A Slave in the White House, Paul Jennings and the Madisons. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
I'm very happy to be here.
How did Paul Jennings come to work for the Madison family? Was he owned by them?
Oh, yes. He was born on their Virginia plantation, Montpelier, in 1799, and he spent his first 10 years there, and he was 10 then when he went to Washington when the Madison administration began in 1809.
At that time, slave owners didn't use last names when they were referring to the people who worked on their farms. Was there a reason, and did that make it a little difficult to find out about the family this man came from?
It is quite true that slave owners rarely deign to use their slaves' last names. Now, that has led to the myth that slaves did not have last names, but research beyond the owners' letters and ledgers has revealed that certainly in almost all cases, slaves had enduring family names. Now, I don't think it's altogether a coincidence in the case of Jennings that his surname is well known and is, in fact, the name of an English merchant. You know that.
But he isn't named Madison.
Oh, no. His father was an English merchant. The idea that slaves took on their master's name after freedom is only true in a relatively small number of cases, as it turns out.
Would we have known about Jennings based on Madison's records?
We would. Madison, in his letters and in the overall Madison canon, including Dolly Madison's letters, for example, Jennings is mentioned a good number of times, yes.
What was life like for people on the Montpelier estate of the Madisons? What kind of working conditions did they have? How long did they work in a typical day? And how did it compare to other estates of the time?
Well, that's a good question. You know, James Madison was an exceptional statesman. He was a political philosopher without peer. But he was a garden variety slave owner. And being a slave on James Madison's Montpelier plantation was not all that different than being a slave on a plantation down the road, given the time and place. So Madison followed what at that point were the established norms and traditions for slaves. And that was a rough life. The slaves worked 6 days a week from sun up to sundown. They worked in the fields. They worked in home industries like blacksmithing or carpentry. And, of course, like Paul Jennings, they worked in the big house. They received certain food rations, we would say very limited by our standards. Many of them supplemented those rations by raising chickens or growing vegetables. The only day of the week that they had off was Sunday, and that was an example of one of their customary rights, and most slave owners felt obligated to follow through on those customary rights. But it really wasn't the living conditions that accounted for the profound insult connected with the enslaved condition. It was much more the inability to determine one's fate or to pass on the fruits of one's labor to one's children.
Well, in the case of James Madison, he helped draft the Declaration of Independence, and I wonder how he rationalized declaring that all men are created equal while he owned slaves and wasn't even a particularly nice slave owner.
You know, there is no question but that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were well aware of the contradiction in their agitating for individual rights, devoting their lives to this issue, and yet being the owners of slaves. Jefferson called slavery an abominable crime, and he allowed that if there should be a contest between slaves and slave owners, that there was no question as to which side God would be on.
So did Madison and Jefferson agree generally? Madison had served in Jefferson's White House as well, so were they buddies and did they agree on these sorts of things?
They were very best friends.
Well, we have three Virginians serving as president in a row, so was that the prevailing attitude in the White House for three terms of different presidents?
The Virginia dynasty, yes. Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, each two terms. And yes, I would say that they had similar attitudes about slavery. Of course, they were all individual slave owners. And on a political level, they would have told you that theoretically, they endorsed the idea of gradual emancipation. But what they could not visualize was a pluralistic society. They felt that white and black could never live harmoniously in America together. And so they also supported the idea of colonization, or the transport of free blacks elsewhere, eventually sort of centering on Liberia Africa.
That happened during the Monroe administration.
The actual formation of Liberia with Monrovia as its capital, yes. Yes. Actually, it came up at the tail end of the Madison administration in 1816.
But the freed slaves thought that Monroe was the person who had freed them, obviously, although it was done by some organization, wasn't it? It wasn't
the American Colonization Society. Madison himself was president of this society during his retirement period. There were very few American slaves that were interested in availing themselves of this opportunity to relocate. African Americans had been on
even
American
if it meant
soil.
Freedom?
Oh, yes, this was their home. Well, you'd have to ask, whether you would ask that of a slave and then give him the option of, would you choose to remain enslaved in America, or if you could be free and transported to the west coast of Africa, what would be your choice? I suppose then you would get some more affirmative answers, but perhaps they would say, could my family come with me? I mean, these are strong family ties, both to the land and to the people.
Hadn't Madison found it necessary to release the servant who'd accompanied him to the Continental Congress?
Yes, this is a very interesting story. This is the story of William Gardner. Though, again, if we had only Madison's records, we would know this individual only by the name of Billy. And when Madison went up to the Continental Congress in 1780, he took Billy Gardner along to serve as his factotum. When it was time to go back to the plantation almost 4 years later, Madison said that it wasn't prudent to bring Billy back, that he'd been tainted. Well, obviously, he'd been tainted with ideas of liberty. The contagion of liberty was going around in Philadelphia in the early 1780s. So he also very...
So he felt he'd be bringing him back to the plantation where he would talk about everybody trying to escape.
That's exactly right. He'd come back with these notions of freedom. Madison said that liberty and learning lean on one another for their mutual and surest support. And he knew that it was also true that if you would keep a people unfree, then you should keep them ignorant.
Dolly's father was a slave owner, but didn't he free most of his slaves?
Well, this is a fascinating instance because Dolly Madison was raised a Quaker, and her father, as a good Quaker, decided that he was duty-bound when Virginia law allowed it to free his slaves. This he did outright and all at once.
Well, but didn't that put him at a disadvantage when he was trying to run a plantation?
He couldn't run a plantation. He had to give up his livelihood. And this is when he moved the family to Philadelphia and tried to pick up on a commercial job, but this did not work out, and he died bankrupt and a broken man.
Is that one of the reasons that Dolly seems to have been committed to the institution of slavery?
One wonders just that. There is no paper trail, but certainly Dolly may have looked back and thought that her father, for all of his sacrifice, came out the loser. And she never did murmur any kind of word of conscience in marrying Madison and herself then presiding over a plantation of 100 slaves.
If anything, it seems like she was a little harder on the slaves than James Madison was.
Well, that's a complicated story, and that's because when Madison died, he bequeathed his slaves to his widow. Now, he had a young man, a member of the rising generation, whom Jefferson predicted would end slavery because they would have taken in ideals of liberty with their mother's milk. And he thought he had talked Madison into freeing his slaves in his will. He was very concerned about Madison's legacy, and he was devastated when he found out that instead he had willed his slaves to Dolly. He said, this is most unfortunate for Mr. Madison's memory and for the peace and happiness of his widow. He has now died without freeing one slave, not even Paul. But he also said he has now imposed on his widow a painful task that he should have dealt with. And that's exactly right.
My guest is Elizabeth Dowling Taylor. Her book, A Slave in the White House, Paul Jennings and the Madisons. It is published by Macmillan Palgrave. So let's talk about Paul Jennings. When he was young, he became responsible for accompanying Dolly Madison's child from her first marriage. She was a widow who married James Madison fairly soon after she was widowed by the standards of the day. But he accompanied her child to school. Is that where he learned to read and write?
Well, you know, Dolly's son by her first marriage, his name is Payne Todd. And in in A Slave in the White House, he serves beautifully in the arc of the story as foil to Paul Jennings because he had every advantage in life and squandered each one, whereas Paul Jennings, even while still a slave, managed to carve out a life of meaning for himself. Part of my research was to track down and interview Paul Jennings' living direct descendants, and I had the great privilege of knowing his great-granddaughter for a year and a half before her own death, and she told me that the family history, and we know Paul was literate as a slave, and of course this was quite unusual.
He wrote a memoir later.
Well, he wrote a memoir in Freedom, but we have letters that he wrote while still a slave. But the family tradition is that he learned to read and write in the presence of the little master, or the white boy, who may well be Payne Todd. And the idea would be that Payne was the recipient of the instruction. Jennings was not, but he was present, just like you said, always present but invisible at the same time, and that he was listening, absorbing, and managed to learn to read and write himself.
How did he wind up with a position in the main house rather than being sent out to the field with other slaves?
Because his mother was a house servant, and such positions were often hereditary among the members of the enslaved community. But at the same time, in order to keep such a position, he would have to show himself capable. And he must have shown himself particularly capable that he was chosen, with his mother not involved as far as going to Washington, at the young age of 10 to be part of the White House domestic staff.
He also was present when some pretty impressive people came to call. Because James Madison was a prominent figure. Do you think he was listening to what was being said?
I absolutely do. He was a good listener, and as it turned out, he was a good networker. It helps to know people in high places, even if you're a slave.
Well, one of the people who came was Christopher McPherson, who was a free African-American who owned his own farm. Was he a slave owner in the way that Edward P. Jones wrote about in The Known World?
Christopher McPherson was at one time a slave. He became a free man. And he was a clerk, and he somehow, quite remarkably, managed to become an acquaintance of both Jefferson and Madison. And
so they could say some of my best friends are black.
Apparently so. It was really quite unusual. McPherson seems to have even been invited to dinner at the Madison dining room table. And in the book, I talk about how the slaves must have just been buzzing over this. This would have been quite out of the ordinary. And maybe, Jennings took after McPherson to that extent of having the audacity to dream big and to want to pursue that most American of promises, the right to rise.
When Madison served as Jefferson's Secretary of State, it's reported that they had these very, very intellectual conversations. I wonder if that was part of Jennings' education as well. Would he have been educated enough to have understood all that talk about philosophy and the Enlightenment?
You know, while Jennings was part of the White House domestic staff, he was a footman. But later, during Madison's two-decade retirement, he had been promoted, if you will, to the position of Madison's personal attendant. So he was in that study where Madison received Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson, Daniel Webster. And during his retirement, his whole endeavor was to organize and review his life's work defending natural rights and self-government. So these were the subjects on his mind, and these were the subjects that he was talking about with these guests. And yes, I think Jennings did pick up the theoretical underpinnings that would allow him to identify his innate yearning for freedom as a natural right of man.
At one point, Madison discovered a letter between Jennings and other servants that made it seem like they were planning to run away. What Madison did was promote Jennings?
Well, something happened behind the scenes that we don't know about. At the tail end of Madison's presidency, this would be in 1816, just 2 months before it was time to go back to the plantation for good after Jennings had come of age in Washington and been there for 8 years. And what we know is that Madison received a letter from his nephew reporting on a rumor that Jennings and two other of the home slaves were going to run away instead of returning to the plantation. We don't know what happened from there. We don't know whether Madison confronted Jennings with this letter. We only know that in the end, Jennings not only returned to Virginia, but was promoted, if you will, to a position of greater responsibility.
But Jennings also helped other people escape.
Yes, the family tradition is that he used his literacy while a slave to write passes and free papers for other slaves.
Now, he eventually bought his own freedom, and we'll get to that in a moment. But is it true that he really helped save Gilbert Stuart's iconic portrait of George Washington during the War of 1812?
Oh, it's absolutely true. This happened on the 24th of August, 1814, in the course of the War of 1812. And on this day, James Madison, commander-in-chief, was literally with the militia at the war front. The problem was the war front was less than 10 miles away from Washington. And when it became clear that they could not hold back the British, word was sent to Dolly at the White House to clear out. Well, she did just that. She jumped into her carriage with some White House treasures. But before she left, she turned to Jennings and two other servants, and she said, "We cannot allow the British to defile this iconic portrait of the father of the country. I want you to save that portrait." This thing was enormous, 95 inches high, much bigger than the 6'3" George Washington himself. And Jennings and these two other servants, with great difficulty, managed to break the frame, and the portrait was carried away as a stretched canvas and miraculously survived, and of course it hangs today in the White House.
Eventually Jennings was able to purchase his own freedom when Dolly Madison was strapped for cash after James died. Where did he get the money from?
Well, he wasn't able to raise it himself. Dolly did set the price low at $200. Jennings, as a skilled houseman, was worth more. And I think that was her gesture to him. But at that time, you know, she was actually hiring him out to President James Polk. So he had a second White House experience that started in 1845. But he determined that he needed to have his freedom. His family, his wife and children, were back in Virginia. And that's when he went to Senator Daniel Webster. Remember I said it helps to have acquaintances in high places.
And Daniel Webster, who had already made a deal with the devil, according to a short story I read many years ago, helped him be freed. He also wrote a memoir called Man's Reminiscences of James Madison, the first White House memoir?
Yes, as decreed by the White House Historical Association, this memoir, which was published in 1865, it's just a slim little volume.
Same year that slavery was eliminated,
yes,
the Emancipation Proclamation.
That's exactly right. In 1865, before the year was out, the 13th Amendment was added to the Constitution, forever forbidding slavery.
And he lived until 1874, years after that, at the age of 75. Were people aware of his legacy?
Well, you know, when he was living in Washington, his backstory was well enough known, for example, that a newspaper woman who was writing a social history went to him for a quote on Dolly Madison. Well, I hope that with this book, A Slave in the White House, he'll be known to a degree that he never has before. And, of course, it was his own reminiscences that I was familiar with that drew me to his story. The title is A Colored Man's Reminiscences of James Madison. But as that title implies, they're more about the so-called great man than about Jennings. So my interest was to find out more about Jennings' story.
And you will find out more about his story from Elizabeth Dowling Taylor's book, A Slave in the White House, Paul Jennings and the Madisons. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.